Just as a reminder, we have three items on the agenda this afternoon. And so time is probably going to be our biggest adversary today. Number three, which is a review of the DMC initiatives and transit and so forth. What I've asked is that they give kind of a very high level, kind of an executive summary of that topic, because at the joint meeting that we have with the DMCC board on Thursday, we're going to hear all this again in even more detail. So you certainly ask questions if you have a burning question, but we're going to try to keep that topic relatively brief.
For the general public, can you tell us where you will sign and where that will be?
What is the... I got to look at my calendar. The calendar myself.
12:30.
Yeah,
MCC.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, 12:30 on Thursday over at the Civic Center meeting room, Riverview Suite. So we're going to hear that topic in much greater detail on Thursday. So if it seems abbreviated, it's a very important topic, no doubt, but if it seems abbreviated, that's why. All right, with that in mind, and again, if the departments and those reviews are just as important, but we'll try to keep those relatively brief, and we'll start off with the... Rochester Public Utilities Department review. Mr. Kochevar.
Good evening. Good afternoon. Well, thank you for allowing me to come to the Committee of the Whole meeting and give you a little bit of an update on the utility. I sent out kind of my summary of last year and year to date previously in the packet, so that information is in there. I won't go over that in any detail. I do want to just point out a couple of highlights I think that are important. One, we are continuing to see increased growth in the utility, doubling the growth we had in 2014, in 2015, and we're on track to match or surpass that growth probably this year. So things are moving and growing in Rochester, and we're seeing that growth. The CapEx 2020 project is an important project to the reliability of the grid and to Rochester. I'm happy to report that project is over 90% complete. Anybody that's been up Highway 52 recently has seen the poles. That's the final stage of that project. That the two main transmission lines that are part of that project that terminate in Rochester and RPU substations are in service and energized, so our level of reliability is where we anticipated it to be once that project was complete. That's about a $43 million investment for the citizens of Rochester in that project. The other big item that occurred last year was the RPU board, along with concurrence of the council, approved moving forward with our new 47 megawatt natural gas fired generating station. That's an important asset to our portfolio to provide quick start, reliable backup to any renewables that may come onto our system. It's important that when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow, that we have a firm supply of generation that we can call on should we need it. And another item of note, as you saw in the budget, to actual results, we did finish the year ahead of plan in terms of net position. Those additional dollars were used for two purposes. One was to fund capital investments that we made in the system and to shore up our cash reserves. As you may recall, 2 years ago we came to the council asking for approval to adopt a three-year rate track to allow us to build up some cash reserves to allow for the future replacement of those assets out of cash rather than burdening the future customers with replacement of existing assets that are used by our existing customers. So we're on track, slightly ahead of track with that rate schedule, so I'm pleased to announce that. And then year-to-date through April, we again are showing positive budget to actual performance for the first few months of the year. It's early in the year though. Obviously our main revenue season is now, the summer season when the loads get up and the temperatures rise. But again, we've got some goals for 16. One is completion of the design and bond issuance of the Westside Energy Station. We plan to start construction either late this year or early next year. We are working diligently on a community solar offering. Our customers have told us that they are interested in an option for them to buy a panel in a facility located remotely from their home or their roof or wherever they may not have a roof space. So we are working with our wholesale power supplier, Simpa, which we have to coordinate with them because of the power sales contract, but I believe we've come up with a workable solution that we can be offering a community solar offering to the community here yet this year. And we'll be you'll hear more about that as our plans get formalized on that offering. And then one last item I do want to bring to your attention. It's not in my my memo, but the Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency has been discussing an amendment to the agency agreement. There are two major contracts that the city signed to become a member of the Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. One is called the agency agreement that formed the agency and its members, and the other is called the power sales contract, which is actually the contract that where we contract for delivery of energy from the agency. The agency agreement sets up kind of the governance of the agency from member voting, the bylaws, and kind of the structure around the agency. When the power sales contract terminates in 2030, we are still a member of the agency under the agency agreement. That does not expire. And so in order for us to continue to do have some sort of relationship with the agency, it made sense to amend that agency agreement to allow us to do what they call project participation. We wouldn't have a power sales contract, but we would be able to participate with the agency in a project should we so desire, and that may have benefit to both the agency and to the city to leave that door open in the future for partnerships. One of the things we're looking at with the agency is the agency is investing in a high voltage transmission line in Wisconsin called the Badger Cooley Project. We have an opportunity post 2030 to participate in that project, which means we would get a revenue stream from that project post 2030, should we take advantage of that. So the reason I bring this up is this agency agreement is a fairly, I don't know what the right legal term is, but it's an agreement that isn't amended easily. It requires two-thirds majority vote of the members. It requires two-thirds of the boards and councils of the membership in order to pass it. So it will, assuming the agency moves forward and the utility board approves these amendment changes, it will come to the council for ultimate approval sometime this fall is the schedule. So I'll get you more information as we get further down the road on what these changes evolve, mean, and how it impacts the city and what opportunities that may bring to the city. But I just wanted to put it on your radar screen so you weren't caught off guard when you start seeing and hearing about it. We did discuss it with the board at a recent study session and had Dave Gushman, the CEO of Simba, come in and go through kind of the details of those, that amendment. So we're starting to work on that. We'll continue to work on that. So with that, I will open it up for any questions you may have.
All right, and that's a helpful clarification because I think most of us were under the impression when that contract ended, the relationship would terminate in its entirety. But what you say makes sense, so we'll look forward to that. Other questions from the council? Mr. Bilibet?
Mark, just one. There's always been some concern and discussion about the ability of natural gas and being able to get into Rochester. So with that natural gas turbine being our backup, are we okay with our supply or should not have an issue with natural gas?
We are okay with that facility. We are going to operate that facility on what's called an interruptible contract. So we will not have a firm supply of gas. So we could get interrupted from the gas company if they have issues with the system. Namely, that occurs in the wintertime. That's their peak gas load. So this unit is really primarily designed to run primarily in the summer months when gas is sufficient at this time. But there is a regional shortage of gas supply, and that's what Merck is working on now through the Public Utilities Commission with their pipeline upgrade case that they've got before the commission. So,
all right. Mr. Ruskin.
Mark, nice job as always. You guys run a good organization out there and always give us good reports and appreciate the partnership. One of the things that caught my ear was the implementation of the use of the iPads that you've done recently with your field crews. Just wondering how, obviously, creates a lot of efficiencies, but also is always a little bit of a challenge in training people that maybe haven't done it or aren't familiar with it. How have you done with that implementation, and then is there been an ongoing training to continue to find efficiencies moving forward?
Yes, there's been ongoing training, and you're right. When we first rolled it out, there were some that were more proficient at using iPads than others, obviously, and we worked closely with all of our staff, and we've got some dedicated GIS folks that are very good with the iPads and spend a lot of time crews. And it didn't take them long to get used to it and get up to speed on it. And we're continuing to look for opportunities to roll out technology in the field. I noted in my one of our goals is we're going to be replacing our customer care and billing system this year. Along with that new software package comes a field mobility module, which we're not implementing at this time, but we've got it on the radar screen for the future, where the crew can get a, let's say it's a street light out request, comes in through via email, it gets dispatched to the crew on the iPad, the crew goes out, fixes the light, puts the COS code back in, and it shows immediately back up at the customer service desk that it's been fixed. So if the customer calls in the next day and wants to know, is it fixed or not, the information is right there for them to answer the question. So, yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Anyone else? Me.
Thank you for our conversation that we had earlier from your report today. Do you have any additional information about broadband and the possible implementation of that down the line?
Sure. We are still working with Dale Martinson and his group on kind of doing the evaluation on the business case that was presented to the council. We are close to wrapping that up, and we'll be looking for a date to come back to the council at some point here late summer, probably early fall, and give you the results of our look at that business case.
Okay, we'll look forward to it. It's before I retire, right?
We'll get here before you retire.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Anything else? Mr. Mayor.
You said that we will have still a relationship with SMPA in 2031. Does that compromise at all our goal of at least trying to be 100% renewable?
No, it should not. The relationship we'll have will be as an agency member, not under a power sales contract where we will take energy from the agency. So that portion will go away in 2030, assuming all things stay as they are today.
And the other was what, the Badger, whatever?
The Badger Cooley transmission line?
That
will not impact our ability to work on that goal.
Okay.
That's strictly a financial transaction. I don't want to take up more time than you've got allotted, but in the world of building transmission, you're either a taker of transmission, you pay for it, or you're a builder of transmission and you get a rate of return for that. We have the opportunity to be a builder in this case, which means we get a revenue stream to offset our expenses that we pay for transmission service. So, but it won't impact the portfolio of energy supply.
But thank you.
In fact, it will enhance the ability of renewables to be on the system and give us access to external renewables if we would want to go that route.
Okay, Mr. Hickey.
So in that relationship, then we'd just be selling excess energy, so if there was a crunch, we'd still have first priority. It's just this excess energy that would be sold.
Right now, all of our energy that we generate gets sold to the MISO market. It's all a wholesale market, and we buy all of our energy off the wholesale market, other than above 216. Right now, SMPA supplies everything up to 216. But they're in the same situation. They buy off the wholesale market and then turn around and resell it to us. Post 2030, we would just buy all of our energy in total off the MISO market, assuming the MISO market looks like it does today then.
Right.
I'm not making any predictions about that. But yeah, we will be a wholesale generator and a wholesale buyer.
All right, thank you.
Regarding your solar options, are you to offer that by wards or by quadrants? How is it offered?
We would open it up to all of our ratepayers. Would have the ability to buy one or more panels in a larger solar garden located somewhere. We haven't figured out a site yet necessarily, but
yeah. You have coupons for discounts.
It will be priced fairly.
But I think to your point, one thing we haven't discussed is whether it's going to be I think the proposal right now is entirely an upfront cash payment to get the panels.
Yes, right now the model we're looking at is a one-time payment per panel, and then we would credit your bill for the output of that panel.
So one of the things that some communities do now is they basically internally finance those so you can pay it off through your energy. Basically the energy you're producing over time. And what that does is rather than being exclusively for people who can afford to write that check up front. You know, at no cost to the utility, you can potentially finance it over time. So I'm going to, when we discuss this a little bit more, I'm going to kind of bring that up as a topic so we can try and expand the availability of renewable energy to a bigger income bracket than what could normally get it.
Thank you.
All right. Anyone else? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll move on to finance and IT departmental review. Mr. Martinson.
Okay. Thank you. So I didn't hand anything out ahead of time. In fact, I just finished it about 5 minutes ago. So
I thought you were going to say because it's all high tech and
on demand.
On demand.
There's always that fear of being the IT guy that can't get that to work.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I will send these out to you on an attachment and an email if you want to look through it later. And I can go, Gary's telling me to get through this fast, so I can go through this as fast as you want, or it can spend however much time you want on a different topic.
He doesn't have to listen to me.
But here's what I'm hoping to cover. What we do, our staffing, our budget results, our 215 initiatives, and our 216 goals and challenges. I just want to start with why we're here. So our department, basically, in my mind, exists to ensure the public trust, because it's not our money, and we're basically here to support the other internal departments. So we don't really provide much of anything to the outside public other than our information, and we're here for everybody else, basically. So you'll see a number of these different projects on a list that other departments may have already talked about. So again, I'll just probably go over them, and if you want to come back and we can talk more about them, I'm sure we can. But in the area of ensuring the public trust, we do a lot of reporting to the public, different kinds of reporting to the bondholders, and now there's a whole lot of discussion about this transparency, just the concept of it's not enough to give you the financial report 4 months after the end of the fiscal year. We have to give you, you know, right now, every minute, every month, that kind of thing, and get into a little discussion about that. And again, we support our internal departments both through operation and management systems, our accounting systems, the funding and financing for different projects that are going on, and then insurance and contracts. And on our information system side of supporting the departments, we provide the data networks, both the wide area networks to all of our different facilities, the computer systems everybody uses, and software support for multiple different systems. And we also take care of City Hall, just another thing to do. Staffing, I just throw up here the 2006 number so you get something to compare it to. In 2016, we had 10 people in the accounting, budgeting, finance area, 2 people in the risk management purchasing area, 2 people plus 0.8 FTEs, I call it. It's about 3 different people that we try and get in the evenings to try and help do all the cleaning and stuff in the City Hall building. And then on the information systems, we have 14 people, plus we picked up 1 summer intern to help us with a couple different projects we're working on. In 2016, you were gracious enough to give us an internal auditor in the finance area. We actually had that position back in about 1994 when I came here, but we finally put it back in here and trying to get that program established and going again. We added an enterprise network security specialist that technically it reports to the city administrator, but when you see the numbers, it's in hours because of accounting. We wanted to have that cost of that sitting in the IT area. And we are not requesting any positions in 17. Not that I wouldn't love to, and not that I don't think we need to. But when we lay out our 5-year staffing plan, we kind of had our turn last year, and we're trying to even that out for the council when we try and make those decisions. And great, again, this is a super great bunch of people to work with. The staff is, just works above and beyond all the time, and get some new people in here now that they come in here and they just cannot believe the breadth of things that we're covering within both our IT and accounting systems, just the different kinds of things and the few number of people we have to do it all that basically have to keep jumping in and doing multiple different jobs all the time. If you talk to the people, they love that part of it. They love the variety and they love how many different things they get involved in. But it does keep everybody more than busy. I'll just quickly run through numbers, trying to get keep into Gary's timeline here, but 13 departments, 141 business units, 878 active projects, 40,000 some payable transactions, checks written are down to 7,600. We keep moving all those things to electronic payments, trying to stop all the paper and all the additional work. 341 insurance claims process. That's not healthcare. That's just workers' comp and property claims liabilities. General ledger transactions about 270,000, and I just mentioned that a lot of those are summarized. We don't bring in all of our depreciation details. We don't bring in. So if you take a look at just payroll alone, there's about 1.5 million almost transactions just in payroll because we have such complex with all of our different unions and different kind of payrolls. It's just incredible. incredible number of transactions. And on the information side, we have 120 servers. There's a little over 90 of those now that are virtualized. 630 personal computers, 778 end users, a number of the people that are out in the field, and so they come in and use shared computers when they're entering their time entry and that kind of thing. 1,682 attached devices, including all the different handheld devices, the different printers, and all the everything that you can imagine that attaches to that network. 1,152 software application installs, different types of software. So again, I talk about the diversity of the organization and how everything is going to getting all of their work done somehow using technology. It's like there's not one division or department that doesn't use it heavily now. And then if you start adding all the different software device controls and versions of all those that we have to keep track of for different computers at different levels and everything, there's over 5,500 of those that we're keeping track of. And over the last year, we had 3,434 help desk tickets cleared, just to give you kind of a picture of what we do. On the budget side, finance came in about $40,000 under, 97% of its budget spent. Most of that was just a kind of delay on hiring one person. City hall maintenance was under $59,000, kind of split between utilities and then contract maintenance. Didn't spend everything we thought we would on some repairs and maintenance areas. And information systems, we came in $269,000 under. Again, most all of that was tied to two different positions that we took us a couple of rounds to get come up with a couple of those IT positions filled because it just was hard in this market to get people within our pay scale. So initiatives. So on the reporting side, the audit and CAFR, we actually have the audit committee coming in on Wednesday, I think, and then we're shooting for the presentation to the full council that we usually do that multi-year trend in the audit report. July 11th, I think is what I'm shooting for. And then OpenGov, which I know a number of, at least a few of you have been waiting for patiently, is getting there. I'll get into that in a minute if we have time. Destination Medical Center actually spent a fair amount of our staff time just kind of made this transition from a lot of the work coming through the Hamus group, and now they hired their own staff, and we're doing the reimbursement on the working capital loan and run through those payments, both the monthly payments, but then now their payroll and other internal operational bills that we're running through. Bond issues, I've never had such a year, actually since the last time we met on this. I've had six different bond issues between Mayo Civic Center, lodging tax bond issue, sales tax bond issue, two refunding issues for ourselves, one refunding issue with the RPU, another bond issue for RPU's temporary financing on the peaking power plant, so it's been a real busy year. Just some of those were private placements that worked out really well, depending upon what we were doing, and some of them were open market bond sales. So we moved our special assessment system, and it took a whole bunch to. We had the same system that was written in house years and years ago. We moved that over to the Logis group. A number of these I kind of list sort of the software name. The DSI is the Park and Rec Facilities Management System. Again, I don't know if they mentioned that in their presentation, but. We spent a lot of time making sure all their transactions and their bookings and their refunds and everything worked well completely with our J.D. Edwards accounting system. Energy improvements at the rec center, you're aware of that one. We're rolling that out now. Got contracts we'll be coming back to you shortly on those improvements. The city hall roof that you probably hear them working on all the time. Hopefully finally getting this to stop leaking. All of our fleet sales went to online now instead of having to wait for this annual auction, which wasn't always lining up very well when people were trying to replace their existing equipment and then get credit for their old one. So those are actually done through publicsurplus.com now. And then just a whole bunch of information requests, this cable TV internet thing you mentioned, hockey arena, we did a Euro hedge transaction with RPU, travel policy changes and so forth. OpenGov, we put over a million and a half transactions into OpenGov so far. So I know people who love to run through data will just have a great time. But we're also trying to put together a number of different pre-made reports so that you can think about a question you might ask about with some financial information and you just click on it and it just pops up the report. It's basically taking all of our transactions and putting them into graphical databases, and you can slice and dice it any way you want. You can add parts of it, you can compare multiple years, or you can take different parts of the division out, and then you can keep clicking on the chart itself and eventually go down into the transactions if you want. a great little system, but it's we just have a lot of stuff to put in there, and we're trying to roll it out first to the division managers so that they can find it a useful tool. And then when we get all the way down to the transaction level, I have to be really careful when I start rolling out to the public that I don't throw any private data in there. So we're doing a whole bunch of scrubbing of the data, and that's what's taking a fair amount of time, just to make sure that if, when we do get this out to the public after the department heads and division managers have had a chance to work with it for a while, and they're comfortable that it's reporting the right things, that we don't somehow expose something that we shouldn't have been. So I appreciate your patience while I work through that. This is just where how I try and simply explain how DMCC works. Now that you got that understood, we'll move on to the next one. But no, so there is, I mean, there is a fair amount of just, I know Gary and admin and us, or me, spend a fair amount of time on just how does this whole thing going to work. But just operationally, there's a fair amount to try and explain and get our staff to put in all the right buckets so that when we come back for reimbursements and all the kinds of things, the way this law was written, that in the end, we know how to do that. The deed auditor was down here, went through our books, and they were comfortable with the whole thing. We have the audit from Clifton Arson Allen that's coming back to the board on Thursday. And we have to wait for all that to get incorporated, because that's actually in our report as well. So it's a fair amount of coordinating. And then, again, the different sources that come from multiple places, all based on certain formulas that all have to match up. So. Onto the IT side of the world, the IT integration project, which I hope you're all aware of, but basically trying to take the city's network, which is everything except the library and RPU, and at least combine as many resources as we can into one shared domain, basically. There will always be some portions of all of the different departments that maybe have things outside of what we call our city back office network. But to the extent that we can, we're going to try and share as many things as we can. And that's a pretty long process, because we have to get everybody on the same page, but then we all, in terms of conceptually, how should this work? So we've done a lot of work on a steering committee on building a framework for it, and then the technical people have been working on a whole, started out with a whole IT security assessment, and then they're building a lot of policies. NERC has a whole section of policies they have to comply with. The criminal justice system has a whole set of computer security policies they have to work with, and we have to take everything in between, make sure everybody's comfortable that everybody understands what the procedures and policies are that are going to keep this network secure, so that they're all willing to be on the same one, and then that we have a process of following through to check it and to test it and all that kind of stuff. So it's taken some time, but it's the most progress I've seen happen on this ever, so I'm really pleased and I'm glad to see it moving along. Laser Feast, we're basically wrapping up phase one of this, and you may recall you gave us a fair amount of money to get this whole imaging digital sort of paperless office concept, which will never quite happen, but we've gone a long ways. And we started out with Aaron's office, and I think you mentioned this already, we've done a number of things on contracts. The last thing we're trying to wrap up is getting the contracts signed from the outside with a digital signature so that we can just send stuff to them electronically and get it back. We've walked through the HR office. They've done a number of different things where we actually start out and build workflow processes first. So it almost starts out as a lean management process first to figure out, well, let's see what you're doing, but how can we do this if we do this all electronically? And then they build that new process, and everything gets routed electronically. We've done the same thing with our accounts payable systems, where we had sort of a quasi-image system. It was sort of quasi-imaged. But we still needed people who are out in the field to be able to sign on paper. We've gotten away from that now, so everything's routed around it electronically, so they can just click off on the different voucher approvals. And we now have, through this process, identified probably 25 more places that departments and divisions want to do with it. So it's kind of our biggest problem with this project is it's so successful that we don't have near enough resources to keep. Because HR would love to just keep that resource there all the time now, but we can't really do that, so we're going to have to figure out how we start leveraging that. That's one of the reasons we have this intern in this summer. So, the Acela permitting system, and again, I assume that they're going to spend some time talking about that with building safety if they haven't already. But again, making progress on there, getting ready to go August and September with some things we've been waiting for a long time, both the scheduling and some of the trade permits at least, some of the actual, like a signing up for a permit online, like a deck permit, is actually turning out to be more complicated than we thought, but the first two are going to be rolling out, and they're figuring out the rest of it. JDE self-service, Linda may have mentioned this one, but we're done with phase one, we're starting to move on phase two, but we're all the employees basically sign on and take care of all their administrative things instead of having all the HR staff, including all the way through benefits enrollment, basically being done online now, and the interface is automatically happening back to the benefits providers. So our pension programs and our health insurance programs, our life insurance programs, you just, the employees sign online, they can't make their changes, HR basically sees it, passes it through, and the interchange goes back and forth between the end users. So. Elements is very similar to what Mark was just describing for them sending out people to fix whatever, a street light, in this case manhole covers, or whatever, Parks and Rec, and I mean Parks and Public Works are both working on this thing called Elements. Again, using, they call them fat finger devices, doesn't necessarily have to be an iPad, but they've been, I think they're a couple of phases through on that. They're kind of taking a division at a time. The special assessments I mentioned on the finance side, we also had a lot of work to do just on all the data conversions on the IT side. Continue to build out the fiber network. I think there's a thing on tonight that is not 63 million. I hope I made that clear. It's 63,000 to get conduit in. I apologize about that. But again, we continue to connect more parts of the network and to make more solid rings in places where we didn't have duplex rings back and forth to our different locations. And facilities expansions, networks in the Mayo Civic Center, Rec Center, and so forth. Again, spend a fair amount of our staff time just making sure that we can tie all that back and support it properly. Kronos system employee time entry upgrade, just about done with that. And going through in 16, again, similar things. We've got this new internal auditor. We're putting out a program that hopefully the departments understand. It's more of a, we're here to help you, and the people usually don't like when you say you're the internal auditor, and we're here to kind of go through your stuff. But open government, I mentioned, again, more bonding issues probably with RPU's peak power plant. Parking related to the development projects, and we still need to figure out some of the answers on DMC, which I think is coming up next, maybe. And then City Hall, the door access. We're changing out our systems from these fobs that you have now to the little cards that we have been using in all the other buildings. And then just this whole study that you've heard about, building security in each of the different locations, or what we end up doing, we're not sure. We're basically just having meetings right now about how do we deal with security for each of our people in each of the City Hall departmental locations. When we change the way you come into the door, but basically people that are at those front counters, especially the clerk's office, trying to figure out how you make the employees feel more secure when people are coming in there, and still be a welcoming place. I mean, that's basically the tough part now. Start putting up solid glass walls and make it hard for people to talk through them and everything, versus having employees feel a little more comfortable in their facility. And again, a whole bunch of them here on the IT side. Integration system continues on. Employees self-service phase two, laser feature phase two, three, four, five, six, seven, and eight. And Acela. Then the whole mobility versus security question. Again, everybody wants to be able to connect from anywhere at any time with anything, but we do have significant security issues we have to work with and work on. And that security assessment that we did pointed out a number of things that all of us need to keep working on, and some of the employees aren't going to like some of the impacts of those, because we still have to, in the end, have a secure network. So more staff, more software implementations, and then sooner or later we're going to have to discuss this whole staffing for the IT side, because a lot of the departments want business analysts / IT analysts. I mean, they want somebody more than just somebody who can interpret and talk IT. They want somebody who actually has some technical skills. But then once we get them involved in the department, it's like getting them back again is hard. And I don't know how we're ultimately going to get around to all that, but we have to address it. And then we have to address the security of all the hosted applications that are going on. And we will eventually have to figure out where we move our failover data system. Right now it's at RPU, but it really isn't technically far enough away. It's nice, it's handy, because we can always get in there and we can always make sure that we have the systems we need there. But right now everything's hot swappable pretty much. If we were to lose City Hall at any moment, we can pretty much fail over. But we're going to eventually have to find some place that's 25, 30 miles away that can do that. So that's all I had. I tried to get through as fast as I could. Any questions?
Well, thanks, Dale, for a great report. Just a few quick items. First off, the OpenGov. I did have a chance to visit with the representative at the League of Minnesota Cities Conference, and they talked about the Rochester project, and I think I'm excited to see where that goes, because we've got a lot of information out there, but it's really only valuable if it's accessible and usable. So I'm excited to see what you're doing there. Acela, comment there. Again, I'm excited to hear what's happening there. Ideally, we should be getting to a point where that entire process is electronic, from plan submission to permit request, review, being able to assess where we're at in that process. That, I think, will go a long way. I think my opinion is, in a lot of that development process, oftentimes the real issues are lack of communication. People get frustrated. They don't know where their project is at. What's the status of my permit, things like that. So I think Acela could perhaps go a long ways in addressing that communication gap, which could in itself help some of that development process. The security thing, I hear what you're saying about redoing the door access. That might also be an opportunity. I don't know if you're looking at it. Do we go to photo ID cards, since you're going to have a card anyway, and kind of take care of two issues with one project to improve security, not only from identifying individuals, but also you've got to do the door access anyway. And then my final comment is on the failover, and I know that it makes all the sense in the world to have an alternative data site. Do we not have capability to, for example, in the public works facility or something like that, or do you have physical facilities in mind where we might have a separate failover data center?
We do have a failover at RPU.
Okay.
And we've had that for quite a while. But I think RPU now is, well, they have one at their water tower, but they do have a data failover someplace. I don't even know where it is, but it's further than 20 miles away or something. I'm not sure, maybe not. Oh, they're talking about it. So again, when you start scoring these things on the, you know, what score are you going to get for your security, one of the things that keeps coming up is if you're going to have a storm come through the area, you might wipe out your backup as well. And Gary wants to get out of the transportation plan.
We're not going to get done. I guess my suggestion would be if you have questions, why don't you write them down and we can bring Dale back to the next meeting on it. My fear is we really need to get through a lot of transit stuff because it's kind of key to the meeting. And I hate to interrupt there, but I don't know how else we're going to get this accomplished. It's a two-hour presentation we're already trying to put into one, and we're under one.
All right. Any other hot questions?
Totally locked out.
Thanks, Dale.
Thanks, Dale.
Really? I have a whole lot of questions.
Yeah. All right. I guess, Mr. Newman, are we done for the day now?
Or?
All right. All right, shoot. You got something on the screen? Or? I think we can leave the I can cover the WMU real quick. I met with Sandra this morning to go over it in detail, I think, which was very useful. We're in the process. As you know, our goals apply to DMC project. Those are those that access DMC funding. We are to the point where the first of those projects is likely to be the Schifolius building, which has a 4% contractor goal, and the parking ramp, which has a 4% contractor goal and a 10% employment goal. That'd be the first time we'll be using employment goals, and I think we're probably the first one in this area that will have employment goals. So one of the things we've been doing is we've been meeting. Brent and I have spent probably a couple hundred hours on this year each, but we're doing it part-time. And we've met with some of the best people in the state that are doing this. We've met with the folks at MnDOT. We've met with the folks at the Minneapolis Civil Rights Unit. We've met with the folks at the Metropolitan Council, the person who ran the Viking Stadium project. We have many more meetings coming up, or not too many. I think we've got about half a dozen or more done. Jim Lasher of SRF has sat in with us on that. One of the things we need in addition to a WMB policy is a clear implementation plan that sets out methodology on how you determine how much for each contract, how do you enforce things, what are the forms you have, all those kind of things. And this is the handout I should have provided already. This is a memo from Brent that goes into what we've been doing. It's got information in there on an outline of this implementation plan, which our goal is to have done in approximately 60 days, I'd say, would be our goal on getting that done. I think the key for us is we need to get some experience and get our first projects under the belt, and then the council can decide, do you want to expand into this further? This is something that we have as a priority, and we're certainly moving ahead on it. I will note that the council did have a voluntary 4% goal for contractors on the Civic Center and the Rec Center. That wasn't required. They're not DMC projects. There was no state requirement for that, and we're above the 4% on both of those, so that has gone very well. Two other things we're looking into. The first is sometimes companies don't know how to get certified for these programs. One of the things we're going to do is also try and link for companies that they can click on, that they know how to get certified both for these programs with the state, locally, and then also there's a state contract process. We buy, it's kind of morphing into the third topic as well, we buy about 80% or more of our everyday supplies off the state contract because it's encouraged, because you got assurance of a good price, and these are contractors that they have, that a lot of the League of Cities, most of them probably go through the state contract. We're trying to see if there's a way to marry that to some of the things. Mayo's got a supplier diversity list. There's also that on the state system, so that we can discuss how we might want to do that if you decide that's a policy you want to adopt. It's a little complicated because we have our purchasing is not centralized. It's every department has a couple of people in that purchase things, and you know, and you're safe because you're usually purchasing off the state contract. So, if we do go down that route, we'd have to train people at each of those departments in how to, you know, both look at the state contract, find these other sources, and then, you know, try and find an equitable percentage that goes to those. So those are the things we've been working on. I was able to give Sandra a little more detail than I was able to provide to you because of time. But I think we're trying to get off to a good start on this. The key will be the first projects will be the Broadway Center, Bloom Project, probably the Lattice Project. Those are big ticket type projects. I will say on the Civic Center, I think we've got, Brent, how much pushing? $5 million in contracts, $4 million?
Like $3.6 million.
In WMB Prep. And Rec Center is $1.1 million?
Yep.
Okay. So about 4.9, whatever, close to $5 million in contracts. So I tried to rush that, unfortunately, because, you know, we're under some time constraints, but if you got a question, I'll take it now. Otherwise, you can ask me later. I talked to Sandra for about an hour today. I think we had a very nice discussion. She had some suggestions for us as well in that meeting.
Question?
I guess
if Sandra's happy, then we're happy.
That was my question, though, is what's your take on where we're at there? Are we doing enough?
Well, first of all, I was really pleased that the Mayo Civic Center and the Rec Center had exceeded the 4%. The other thing that was, I think the implementation plan is a plan that's going to lead throughout the state once it's done. And it's how do you do it, when do you do it, how do you measure it, what are the goals, those kinds of statements that you'll see in the package. So in the short time, I don't know if you feel it's a short time, but within this year, I think there's been a lot to cover. I think it's important that we have those goals in place and we can measure it. And if someone is not meeting those goals and they've made some good faith effort, we can continue to document that. And also I suggested that perhaps it could even be in the performance evaluation goals our department heads, so that they can know that this is important to us as a community, it's important to us as a city, and throughout the state. So I think it was a good discussion. I haven't actually had time to read all of it myself, but I'm just glad that we're moving forward in that both Gary and Brent have spent the kind of time that they have on getting this underway. And I think you'll be sharing it with the DOC board as well. So that was one of the things that the Lieutenant Governor talked about. It's been months ago, a 4% goal, and we were not focusing on that at the time. So now there is that focus, and I think it's appropriate.
We'll say the folks we got with were tremendously helpful. They gave us all kinds of documents that we're reviewing. So we really do thank them for helping us on that.
Okay, all right, move on.
Okay. I don't know if anybody else is
master plan in terms of goals and objectives. And part of our challenge is just managing transportation, making sure that we can continue to get more and more people in and out of our downtown, and to make it as convenient as possible, and to continue to contribute toward that economic development opportunity that we really have. So over the last 6 months or so, there have been a number of major developments. Some of them are still speculative, and other ones have developed into formal proposals, but some of those are including significant amounts of parking beyond what they need for their own project. And the question about the future need for parking reservoirs and the amount of parking has come up at the DMCC board, and there were questions about what are we doing now to address these issues, and what can we do in the near term versus waiting until all the transit studies are completed so we can get to some answers and give some clearer guidance around what we need and what we actually need to do in order to make sure we don't create an oversupply that has unintended consequences in the short term. So we've had several discussions around different strategies we might want to think about. And we think that a pathway for us to move forward on is something that we'll do fairly quickly, is to establish a parking overlay zoning district within the DMC development plan boundary that will help to address some of the strategic issues we have around parking and around travel management, and again, continuing to make sure that we can get more and more people in and out of our downtown as conveniently as possible. There are a number of key issues that we're trying to address with this. I'm going to ask Charlie to give the high level on what items we think we can address and the timeline in which we are proposing we could move forward with that.
Okay. Thank you. Look at the second page. One thing I just want to highlight before we get to some of the specifics. Under the section on background there, I think it's important to keep in mind what the DMC plan talks about in regards to parking. And that's why I tried to highlight these here. The first bullet point, parking, it basically is equal to access, and that you don't want your parking supply to exceed the amount of vehicle capacity that you have on your street system to serve that parking. So that kind of creates, I'm going to call it a hard cap by any means, but it provides a guideline in terms of how much parking we should be thinking of providing in the district. Another thing to keep in mind is that the plan discusses goes beyond our traditional way of handling parking, which is basically to look at the intensity or the size of a development and assess parking on providing a parking space per so many square feet. So, for example, we have an office requirement, which is like one space for 200 square feet, retail, one space for 400 square feet in the land development manual. The DMC plan talks about is really sort of moving away from that physical dimension and starting to look more at the markets themselves. So what the DMC plan suggests is that the people that we should be providing parking for within the district are the residents, customers of businesses, retail shops, patients, and visitors. We also have the role of parking, which would be in the district to serve public purposes like events at Mayo Civic Center, the library, and those kinds of things. But the main point of the DMC vision is that parking that I sort of phrase as long-term, low turnover parking. So, for example, employee parking where they're coming early in the morning, parking their car, and that car never leaves, right, till the end of the day. That type of parking is the focus of trying to get that outside. Any parking, any access travel that we want to try and remove from the downtown area, it's that particular function, that particular group of motorists. So, what we're trying to do in the ordinance then
and some of our suggestions here is start to kind of move us away, as I say, from sort of this look at just the size of the development and start thinking about these markets and parking for the appropriate users. I guess we turn to the third page. Here is kind of a list of some of the factors that we think would be appropriate in the interim ordinance. They fall into basically three main groups of potential requirements. The first one being guidelines on the actual parking supply that would apply to a development. The second one would be how we would look at public assistance for parking for developments within the district. And the third one would be travel reduction and how we would consider travel reduction and traffic impact. So real quickly, some of the things that we're looking at in terms of parking supply, obviously we're going to, we would need to define the area, which probably would be the boundaries of the DMC district. We think in terms of required parking for a development, in our staff discussions, we do think that there is a need to maintain some requirement in terms of minimum amount of parking. We think that in addition to that, there should also be a maximum amount of parking for a development established. And that won't be, our thinking is that that's not a hard and fast number, but that starts to reflect the idea of a policy and an approach suggesting the DMC plan called shared parking. So what that means is basically, whereas today when we look at a mixed-use development, or let's say we have a residential component, an office component, a retail component, we look at each of those individually and assume that whatever the residential component needs for parking, that they need that 24/7. Same thing with the office use, same thing with the retail use. But the reality is each of those uses have different demands during different periods of the day. So the concept of shared parking is that rather than just taking this 24/7 look, you actually break it down and analyze morning peak need, afternoon peak need, evening peak need to develop what your total parking demand for a development will be. And typically, you will find that probably will be somewhere between 20-35% less overall parking is needed to meet the parking demand under a shared approach as opposed to a more traditional approach. So we'll obviously bring forward information on that as the discussions about this proceed in the next weeks. Some of the other potential factors that would come into play here, we think, would be location of parking. We want to provide the ability for a developer, if they so choose, to provide parking off-site. So there would be some language about that. The issue of public parking and incorporating that into a development. Where we're at with that is thinking of proposing the idea that since most of these downtown projects tend to have a pretty long gestation period where it takes 6-9 years to negotiate development. What we would suggest doing is that at the initial contact with the developer is to indicate to them that we would like them to do their preliminary planning based on the idea that there may be one or two floors of public parking provided. And then during the course of the negotiations, the city would then do some further analysis and make a decision so that when it got to the point of negotiating a development agreement, the city would indicate to the developer how much public parking we actually do want to include in the development. And we're taking the approach that we're doing it on a floor, not saying, 20 space or 50 space, but saying one floor in, one floor out, two floors in, because it's a lot easier for the developers to adjust their plans when they're just having to work, when they can work with an entire floor and even pull it out and put it in. So that's kind of the concept behind that. Given the uncertainty relative to off-site employee parking, we're thinking that for this interim period, probably the best approach would be to not provide for any off-site employee parking within a development. So that means, for example, a lattice, we'll just take any of the excess parking beyond their need would not be targeted to employees. It may be for public use, or there may be some other need that's identified, but in terms of off-site employee parking, that might serve mail, for example, or some other uses that would not be provided for in this interim period. The second main thing that, you know, we're thinking there'd be a section that would talk about the idea of public parking and providing assistance to developers to support that public parking inclusion. So there would be some clarity around that regarding, you know, what is considered public parking. Basically, the policy in the past has been public parking is either to provide for public use, like the civic center, like the library, or it's to supplement the supply of parking that's available for short-term, high-turnover kind of parking, like retail uses in the downtown core. For example, historically, it's one public parking need that the city has contributed towards. So it would be those kinds of uses. The city would not be providing assistance, again, to off-site employee parking as a policy in this interim period. And then in terms of the third major area, going to the fourth page, we think that we should begin, even though, you know, we don't have the studies fully completed, but we should begin to do some of the easy things, I guess I'll call them, so to speak, in terms of trying to encourage travel reduction and minimizing parking. So there would be some requirements that we think could be included in the ordinance, things like that we would ask the developer to work with the city transit system to provide free parking passes, either if they have residents or if it's non-residential employees. This is a suggestion that is actually already in the downtown master plan, even preceding the DMC plan, that kind of program be put in place. And that's something that transit folks are already set up to do. Some of the other basic things, particularly in regards to residential development, would be for larger developments, and I should point out these travel reduction requirements would apply only to developments exceeding some threshold, like over 250 spaces, that they would provide a car sharing program. So we have some initial examples of that already happening with it's Matt Campbellman on some of his downtown residential developments where he provides car sharing, and also including bicycle parking in the development. And then, so those things we think should almost be requirements. And then there's probably some other optional things. One example, we try and look at providing an incentive to the developer maybe to take the approach of unbundling parking from the rent cost. So this is a concept that's been tried in a lot of cities and is pretty successful, where, for example, they're using a residential tenant. Instead of just them having the choice of one cost that pays for both their residential unit and their parking, to separate those costs so that any tenant looking at renting a unit in a development has a cost for renting the unit, but then they have a choice to make. If they don't have a car, then they don't have to rent the parking space. So it gives the tenant flexibility. It also gives the developer flexibility. We're thinking that we would try and incentivize that to happen, and the incentive for the developer would be if, in fact, he or she has tenants that do not want parking, he would then be able to sell that parking on a leased basis. So that would be the incentive for the developer. And then the last factor would be we think that we need, given the fact that our street capacity is somewhat critical, and how that's impacted, that as part of a consideration of any of these large developments, again, whether they're over 250 or whatever threshold we set, that we analyze what the impact of that, the traffic generation, is going to be on available capacity at each of the entryways into the downtown, and at least for this interim period, set a criteria that they cannot use up more than 10% of capacity at any given location. So,
and
again,
just focused on peak hour right now.
Focused on peak hour, right. So if it's an off-evening use, an event-type thing or whatever, Civic Center probably more off-peak. So, but just a number of factors that we thought it is for a starting point to give us something to work from. And we will be working with SRF, our program consultant, on kind of refining this as we go forward.
The intent of this is just a potential interim policy. You'd have to take this out to the community and get some comments first, hopefully not for too long, because, I mean, the idea is that put something in place until you get far enough along in your studies so you know where you're going to be putting peripheral parking and have some of the information on how your final system might look, which you don't have now, but we do have, you know, quite a number of proposals coming in, and some of them do have, for example, building excess parking for monthly contract sales, which then just brings more cars downtown and may not what you want be what you want to do on a short-term basis. We have discussed with developers, you know, this whole concept we did with the Rutger project, and we are again with the Lattice project, trying to identify if areas where there's some short-term parking needs, looks like, you know, maybe not employee parking, but like in the Second Street area, other areas. We've already discussed this concept of us maybe, using TIF dollars to have one level that would be for public parking and work with them on an agreement that allows us to establish the rates or work with them to establish the rates to ensure that it's public parking. So that's a concept we already were kind of morphing into in the interim to try and address some of the public parking needs rather than building a public 8-story ramp somewhere and putting that up. So
I just want to add to this, kind of that conversation around employee parking or long-term parkers. What is the challenge with that? Most of those come and go during peak hour travel, so that puts the most pressure on those limited capacity portals every day. So that's one issue. Another one is that those are the ones that stay in place for the longest duration of any given time frame. And many of them are accommodated by shuttle lots and park and ride facilities. The other thing is that, for those who don't know, Mayo has long had its own travel demand management strategy internally, and that helps to manage the demand on their parking and the demand on the street capacities. And inducing a huge supply of long-term parking for day users might end up offsetting some of the strategies they've already been implementing.
One last comment, and that's the we're not trying to make the system so lean it doesn't meet the needs of the developers and their people providing their financing. I mean, in a lot of cases, their lenders will be saying, you have X number of parking spaces we want you to have. So we're not going to, you know, this would be a guideline rather, and some of these things we could probably adopt prescriptively, but generally it's a guideline to try and do things a little better in the interim. But we also don't want to get into the situation where all of a sudden the development is going to go away because their lenders say you're not providing the parking enough to justify the loan that I'm giving you, which in some cases does occur. So.
The other thing is that in our core of our downtown, we have virtually no parking requirements now. So we would actually be introducing some minimums.
So I think the thought at this point, and we got a bunch of other information on the transit studies to convey, is that, you know, if you you haven't had much chance to look this over, but if you think about this, do you think this is a good topic to start discussing and take it to some, get some comments on it in the community and start the process through the Planning Commission, or do you want more time to discuss it, to review it and discuss it?
Mr. Hickey?
As an engineer, I'm always looking for real-world examples, so I just would like to see maybe some cities that have had similar changes like this that are successful models, and we're taking the best practices as we go forward, and just make sure it's not just kind of theoretical concepts. So, I mean, a lot of this sounds very promising. It's always helpful to see real-world examples where it's been successful before.
Yeah, we'll certainly provide that. There's plenty of examples. Yeah,
thanks.
Mr. Ruska?
Take some notes here and listen to you. I find it impressive that Mac Hamilton's taking the lead and kind of setting an example for the traffic reduction. It's good to see that he's out there doing that and that people are working and thinking about this stuff. But With that, one of the biggest things that I'm hoping to see in this whole process is the uniqueness of Rochester and what we have here. I noticed you're talking about 0.4 of the medical center parking in the Mail Master Plan, but with that, I'm concerned about what are the percentage of the male visitors that drive to the downtown that come in here as patients and as guests and expect, they're in a kind of a critical time of their life. They need to have that little bit of kind of security of their own vehicles, their suitcases, and that kind of stuff. And so I hope, are you applying the fact that we are a different city than a lot of the places that maybe you're studying or that you're using examples from?
Right. Visitors, shoppers, residents, all those people will be accommodated. I mean, that's the principle of the DMC plan.
Yep. I just want to make sure that is, that's critically important to us. It seems like we start going into other cities are doing, and I want us to make sure that we remember kind of our setup here and the uniqueness of what it is.
We did have some early discussion with Mayo staff before we even put this together.
And their master plan, does that include a lot of the guests? I assume that's predominantly their staff and their parking for their own employees and everything.
Yeah. If you look in their master plan, their parking section, they talk about both. They talk about their employees and they talk about their visitor and patient needs.
And they've indicated they do need to build some patient parking.
Yeah.
And I think they are in agreement with trying to move the employee parking further out, but they definitely have some patient parking needs that they'll need to be addressing.
Is that a good division of responsibility for us to pursue as Mayo takes the lead on the patient parking? Instead of having everyone try and build out all the types of parking, does it make more sense to have specific organizations focusing on the different types that maybe we have domain expertise in providing?
Seems like by default they really have taken care of most of the patient parking needs. And as we move forward with the additional studies, we're going to be working closely with the Mayo staff and looking at the strategies that work best overall. And if there are some opportunities to do some sharing with those parking facilities, then I think that's something that we need to look at. Even if it means one entity builds the parking primarily for maybe patients and visitors, and that others have parking, but they have different times of their needs.
And there's sort of a two parts of, I think, the patient companion demand, which is some of them, are in hotels downtown. So that parking, that's parking that we want to be able to provide within the district.
I was just,
and then there's the drive-in, that aren't downtown and they're driving in. Well, they may be coming in on shuttles, that's certainly a big part of it, or they may be driving themselves. So I think that's going to be Mayo, Mayo's going to want to be able to manage that.
That was a test question. I just wanted to make sure we had the answer that we're going to work together to meet the demand here. Because it is one of those things where it seems obvious that, we have different organizations that do what we do best, but it has to be a system. I had two other points, if I can go here quickly. One is, why set a minimum parking?
Well, there seems to be a need for us to make sure that those who are generating demands for parking are providing some minimum amount of that within their development costs and their development themselves, and not simply pushing that burden onto the city to be the supplier of that.
I think we're looking at changing our mode. We've got 3,000 plus parking spaces downtown, and building ramps is very expensive. And I do think the people that are coming in are proposing to build parking. All the developers that we've had come in, so I think they're it says in the CBD area that they don't have to provide parking. The assumption city's going to provide it. Well, we may not always provide it. I mean, we have to provide some for the events. Our ramps currently do share, it's kind of an example of shared parking because we rent out, 1,000 spaces to employees in our ramps, which gives us extra capacity at some point. If we get such a great retail or visitor demand, it would give us room to move those contracts out. But
I think
we're thinking that the minimum would be, so at least somebody's not coming in saying, well, you're building me all the parking. Well, we can always say no, obviously, but at least to set some kind of guideline that. And it's fairly low. Our standard, even in the fringe area, is 0.5 rather than 1. Not 1-to-1, but half a parking share for a unit or whatever the specific use is.
I'd like to see projects below a certain threshold exempted entirely, because I think there should be a certain dollar amount where we basically say, let's let the rules apply. I think if we're talking 250 unit or parking spaces, that could be a different issue. The only other one is, like, I wanted to comment that I like this approach for drafting new legislation, so I appreciate staff coming forward with a bunch of bullet points and some supporting information in here. But I see that it says the council, you know, your timeline is basically July. Is it something where we're uncomfortable moving sooner than that to initiate? Because I assume with something like this, we can basically say, hey, barring supporting data, which we'd all like to see, we'd like to initiate the start of staff drafting this to bring back.
Well, here's our hope is to get a head lab today, that you're comfortable enough with us to go ahead and get some language drafted.
Okay.
So that we can bring that back to you as quickly as possible, and that would be the point at which we'd say, are you okay with initiating?
You want to have the language before we initiate.
I think so.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
So you can get have more time to look at it. I mean, this has caught you kind of cold here, but I do think there are some. I think the staff who's working on that's these two and Ken and Richard and his folks. I think they've done a good job of coming up with some good suggestions. So,
Mr. Woodger,
I'd echo the why on the minimums. Slightly different reasoning. One that, you know, the financial experts within the banks making these loans are going to be far better at determining what the minimum level required is to be successful than we're going to be. So, you know, a lot of cities have realized that the experts are involved in these projects and the minimum is really unneeded regulation. I also support exempting small projects, forcing parking into places. And we just actually recently did this, but I had to go through a burdensome process for a small business locating in a building that's been there for 60, 80 years on 2nd Street. We basically are, there was a request, I don't know if it's gone to the council yet, to not have parking there because they haven't had parking for God knows how many years. This is helpful. I mean, it would have been good from my standpoint to get this before this meeting. It's a little bit hard to kind of look back and forth and look at this, but I point up the road. I don't believe that there's anything really magical about the needs of Rochester relative to other similar sized cities with similar sized visitor populations, but Minneapolis has done so many wonderful things that have worked well in this climate, and I'd love to see us replicate a lot of those, particularly really cutting back on the need for parking and using more structured parking in the nodes, high-frequency transit areas, which we don't have yet, but I hear it's coming.
We're certainly looking at best practices and solutions that have worked well in cities, but I just also want to emphasize we're not proposing this is going to be our long-term fix for everything.
No.
This isn't for the interim period because what we have right now isn't sufficient. Where we're headed, we're not exactly sure because we still have to sort out some details, so we need to bridge that somehow, and that's really what we're after.
So we'll flesh this out and bring it back to you in a couple of weeks. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Mitzi, I like it. I think this makes a lot of sense. It's something we've struggled with for a long time. I think this, instead of looking at it as a negative, I think this helps developers figure out where they have to be as well. I think we can make it simpler for everybody all the way around. I do agree with Mr. Higgins. We need to get some showing of some cities where this is working, how well it's working. The Mayo, as you said, have been doing a lot of this for a long time, putting the parking lots out in the way and using the bus transportation method to get people there. I think it kind of levels the playing field for everybody that wants to come to Rochester. We have a lot of groups that are looking to come to Rochester right now, and it makes a lot of sense for them to have an idea of what they need to do. So I think putting an interim program like this in place makes a lot of sense.
Okay. Can we move on to our second phase? Is that discussing the studies that we need to get? This will be going to the DMC board and coming to you guys in July for approval. So,
now that you're settled in, I mentioned to President Staver before the meeting that we really needed about 2 hours total today, and we've got 15 minutes. So what we're going to do is give you a very high level view of this, and as was suggested by Michael earlier, to get this in advance. Well, all of this is going to be discussed again Thursday afternoon. Michael.
So we're getting it in advance.
So you're getting it in advance.
Oh, did
they get
one?
So you've got a packet, you're getting a single sheet here, and we're going to start with the single sheet to begin with. What we've attempted to do is put together kind of a one-page front and back fact sheet here. So the single sheet,
that's right there in front of Sandra. You've all got that, if you refer to that. So what we're going to talk about briefly today is what the enhancements are that are necessary to the transportation plan, chapter six of the DMC plan, to deal with refinements and some additional studies that are necessary. So what is proposed? Well, we need to advance these transportation concepts, and we're proposing to do it in the form of four studies. The downtown transit circulator and operation study, you've heard a lot about the circulator. The second one would be the downtown street use and operation study. We're going to talk about that in a minute. Parking and travel demand management, Mitzi was just alluding to that. The parking and also the travel demand management, which is the really key portion of the parking study and the city loop study. So what we've determined is the most successful way to manage this is to have these four studies done concurrently by a team of very highly qualified experts and managed by, the program will be managed by SRF. The purposes of the studies are listed there. I'm not going to read this to you. We don't have time, but hopefully between now and Thursday, you'll have an opportunity to look at. But again, the primary purpose is to refine the work that was completed in the DMC visioning process. Again, the DMC plan is a vision plan, and what we need to do is determine whether the concepts are feasible, whether there's the right-of-way widths downtown seem very wide when you're trying to cross the street from side to side, but as cities go, they're actually fairly narrow, and we're going to have a lot of competing uses downtown, as you heard with the DMC design guidelines, with pedestrians and bikes and transit all having a higher priority of cars. There isn't a lot of right-of-way width available for us to accommodate all modes. So we're going to be getting into more refined studies to look at that. If you look, quickly go to the back, I think the table there on the second page, this is a thing that's very near and dear to Gary, the illustrative table here. In the blue, you see the aspirational level of funding that's laid out in the DMC plan. In the green, you see the Newman plan, which is the more conservative level, the more what we think maybe realistic level of funding at this point. But it just talks about, you know, a $900 million of DMC investment, public investment of $650 million. Transportation investment approaching $400 million. So I guess what this is all about is basically trying to explain to you why we think these additional studies are necessary. We find ourselves in a situation where perception and reality right now are not matching up very well. There's a perception that the DMC plan got us to about an 8 on a scale of 0 to 10. That we're in an 8. We're ready to go. We're ready to start building things and the transportation networks and this and that. And in reality, from our perspective, so the perception is we're at 8. In reality, we believe we're at a 2 right now. There's a lot of work to get from that 2 to that 8, and that's what we're going to talk to you about today. So with that, Gary, if you want to kind of... So in the front of your clip thing is the agenda, and we're going to, like say, quickly run through this. We're at number 2 now. Gary's going to talk a little bit about the DMC plan and what you adopted. So
let's just, the middle page, your agenda 2, what the DMC plan did, what the approval of the plan was and what it was not. This was a slide from your public hearing. This is nothing new. You've seen that before. You know, it does point out that, you know, it's a guideline and it's a tool to support economic development, provides a work plan, establishes evaluation criteria, an outline of planned public infrastructure. But it wasn't, you know, a block-by-block rezoning of the whole downtown. I mean, we would have had to rezone every block in the downtown, which obviously isn't feasible to do. And so it provides a good vision and it provides a good framework, a good outline. But then now we got to get down to the specifics. You know, it does say here, it wasn't establishment of an ongoing tax. Well, you've done that since. I mean, you've established the tax that we're paying for this with. So that's all that that covered. The next page, though, does cover, in the public hearing, we also had you adopted a resolution, and in that were findings that were from the Planning Commission, number 9 on there, which is in the yellow sheet, it does point out these transit studies. If you look at the last sentence in there, this was all part of the resolution that you adopted. But the bottom line of that, Section 9, said, these studies should include a transit street capacity system study, a downtown parking and park and ride needs study, a downtown access authority study, a City Loop cultural crescent implementation study. Those are the studies that we're discussing, and they've, you know, gotten to the point where they had earlier request for proposals and qualifications, and now they're in the process of saying, here would be the consultants that would be doing these studies, and they'll provide you information on that. Do you follow? That's what we had, that's what you adopted. So this is really not for your group here is nothing new at this point. Correct? Okay.
So the next item in your packet. So we have a lot of visuals today, and we'd like some feedback on these, whether they're clear and they tell the story, and that let me know between now and Thursday. But so the next one is agenda item 3A, is the relationship of the travel mode studies. And what we try to show you in this is that these four studies are very integral to building a successful program. We could do them each independently, and we would get results. But if I don't know what the street use and capacity of every street downtown is, and I don't establish that in the process, and all of a sudden then we want to put a circulator on that, we want bike lanes, and we want bulb outs at the intersections for short pedestrian crossings. If all of those aren't coordinated, we're going to have a lot of conflicts by the time we're done. So again, the Second Street Corridor study in front of St. Mary's, a lot of discussion about that. How many lanes do we need there for traffic? How many lanes do we, what if we have a circulator? How's that going to operate? What impact is that going to have on the vehicular use in the corridor? Do we need bike lanes? All of those things need to be evaluated further. So the vision suggests a circulator on Second Street. It suggests a circulator on 3rd and 4th Avenues, running in front of the Gonda building, going north on 3rd, and coming south on 4th. I personally struggle with the access to the Gonda building and some of the challenges that Mayo has today with pedestrians and vehicles and not only getting in but getting out of that drop-off. And now we're going to run a circulator up that corridor and a bike lane, a two-way bike lane as is shown in the plan. Yeah, maybe it all can work, but we really haven't done our due diligence to show that all of those uses in that corridor will work and that they're supported not only by the capacity of the respective networks, but they all work together. If we have all those uses in that space, do they work well together? So again, this example here is just to show how these will tend to build on each other, and we're going to be working on them concurrently and sharing information all the way along through the process.
So now to jump in a little into the detail a little bit, my thankless job here today. So you should have a page that at the top says agenda item 3B with the little graphic in the upper right. So this summary of what's here is really just an introduction to our specific summaries about each of the studies, which I'll touch on here in a second. I think kind of picking up on Richard's comment, the first bullet there, I think, highlights, you know, the way I like to think of this, which is about the DMC plan established a compelling vision for what we want downtown to become. And this work that we're going to get started that we are proposing is really to flesh out how do we execute that vision. How do we get getting into the nitty-gritty, all the details, including design, funding, impacts to property owners, all those kinds of questions at the necessary level of detail. If you look at the graphic there for a second, what I've highlighted there is kind of a typical process, particularly if you think of a construction-type project for transportation, the number of steps that normally have to be walked through to get us to the point where we can actually begin construction. And what the DMC plan addressed is really that first bullet of identifying the needs, what the travel demands are, and developing concepts. And it got into, at a high level, the second bullet, which is all analyzing the alternatives at a high level. But you know, whether it's because of federal funding requirements or other environmental requirements, we need to do a more fuller assessment of the alternatives and get that complete. We have to get into concept design for some things like the circulator, where we expect to pursue federal money. There'll have to be a federal environmental assessment completed, which is a pretty detailed document. Once we get through those phases, we're looking at things like preliminary design and leading to final design. The whole issue of procurement, if there's right-of-way needed, securing the funding. You know, some of these things, again, like a circulator, is probably going to involve a number of different funding sources. Some of it may be private. How to package that and put that all together, you know, is an issue that will have to be dealt with down the road. So a number of steps that we need to go through here. The third bullet on this page just highlights, you know, from my perspective, what we've accomplished so far with the work that was done on the DMC plan. Things like establishing the goals and objectives, identifying what the problems potentially could be and what the solutions to those problems might be. Analyzing at a high level, kind of at a whatever number you want to choose, 5,000, 10,000 foot level, what the possible solutions are, and whether kind of at a first cut, whether there's any, were any red flags identified for any of those possible solutions that might kick them out at an early stage, but gave us sort of a blueprint to work from as we move ahead. If you go to the next couple pages, what we try to do is get into a little more detail. As we said, we have four studies. What we try to do on each of these sheets then is kind of present on the left-hand side the work, kind of the main, kind of a summary of the main items that came out of the DMC study and DMC plan relative to each of these studies. And then in the right-hand column, summarize what we see as the main task or main elements of work that need to be completed now in the subsequent follow-up phase of work. Again, probably rather than going through it today, I'll leave that for Thursday. You can take a look at it, you know, between now and then, and bring your questions on Thursday. But again, that was sort of the purpose of these four sheets.
So we've kind of got this pictorial explanation, as Charlie gave you, of the four studies. Also in your packet then, there are four kind of executive summaries, more narrative to that. And included in that then is about a page and a half explanation, the major study task, the travel modes it affects, an operational analysis. We get into staffing, who's doing what. Let me just take a second to talk about, we had seven teams propose on doing the program management. We selected SRF. Ken Holte here is the program manager for SRF. But the other six still had a very sincere interest in being part of seeing the vision come true. And I was really compelled by that to see how I can involve them, continue to have them involved. Because it takes a lot of time and effort to put together a proposal. So we asked them to submit further information on what technical areas, expertise they could bring to realizing the vision. And we've put together then a team, and I guess probably at this point, maybe I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but going to this org chart here, looks like this. It's the title is Agenda Item 5. We've then basically received proposals from a group of firms, and we've been able to include them all based on their levels of expertise in some of these studies, kind of across the middle. So we've got the street use and operation study, the parking and TMA, the city loop, and the transit circulation. And we've been able to, and it shows SRF basically providing, again, some program management there. But we've got a number of firms. We've got Kimley & Horn. We've got SCH. We've got AECOM, Stantec, WSB. We've got a lot of all the other firms that proposed initially have a role to play going forward. So we put together this org chart, again, SRF providing some program management levels of effort in here. And in addition, what we've done is that you've all met Tom Brennan before. Tom was involved with Nelson Nygaard. He was the lead transportation study expert in the DMC plan. And they actually did propose on some of these specific projects, and they have a little bit of actual technical role. But we felt Tom had so much experience working with Rochester. He's been working with our staff. He's been working on the comp plan. He worked on the DMC plan for about going on, I would say, almost 7 to 8 years now. He probably has more knowledge about our system overall and Mayo system than any individual, with the exception probably of Charlie, you know, within the city organization or Mayo's organization. We felt it was really important for Tom to have a role here, and we put him in an advisory, associate advisory role, kind of helping us oversee all of these studies as they come together. So I'll let you look at that. I'm going to back up a second then to task number four, agenda item number four, which is the fold-out, which is the budget. A lot of information here. Not going to spend really any time going through this other than saying that the vertical, I'll call them light red or pink columns, are very significant milestones in the schedule. So again, at the beginning, the cross-project interaction and information sharing, basically the data drop, the data collection and data drop that we're going to get from the DMC consultants that worked on the initial study, then looking at the needs and goals in about January, evaluate options in April of next year, and then a preferred alternative a little bit more than a year from now in August of 2017. And then all of the various tasks based on the respective studies. So again, a lot of information here. The other black lines, there's some black vertical lines within the red columns, and those basically are, again, key decision points where information is shared, specific information is shared and relied upon by those conducting other portions of the studies. So there's been some concern that maybe we've got too many cooks in the kitchen. We don't think so. We've brought together what we've kind of called our dream team here of experts from around the country who are, again, expressed interest in the DMC plan, have had some active role already and wanted to continue to be involved. And so instead of, again, going back and having to re-educate a lot of different firms, these firms have stepped up and are proposing to provide us some excellent services as we move forward.
Richard, do you want to mention hours versus number? It's based on the hours worked. You're going to have the same hours.
Yeah, and again, Ken won't like to hear me say this, but I kind of look when I evaluate consultants' proposals. To be competitive, they have to pay their people very comparably. And so it's really about level of effort. It's not about the cost per hour that they might pay one person or another. It's about the level of expertise and the level of effort they're putting forth. And so, again, SRF is providing this program management. They're reviewing these proposals when they come in. Tom Brennan's looked at them. They're making adjustments. So we're basically tweaking right now the budget and the hours. I don't have any information on the budget to share with you today. We'll have it on Thursday because we're still tweaking some of that. But we've a high level of scrutiny on the level of effort that's necessary. Again, relying on Tom's expertise of what's already been studied, Charlie and Ken's involvement with some of that already, to kind of get to a level of effort and ultimately a cost then that's necessary to accomplish this work. We're under a lot of scrutiny right now about the speed at which we're not moving. Again, I think it gets back a lot to the reality and perception of where we are. So we've got to get to an 8 as quickly as we can. We think within 6 months to 8 months, we're going to be able to have some key information available that's really going to start to shape the studies for some great, very good public input processes next year. And that's one other point I just want to talk about. I realize we're running a little long here, but the coordination of the public input and the public outreach is going to be very critical. All the way through the DMC process, there was a concern by the EDA staff, and justifiably so, with our comp plan going on, the DMC study going on, some other initiatives in the community, we're going to be surveying people to death in the community. And we want to make sure that all of these, again, one reason for integrating all of this together is that we don't have four different consultants going out on four different studies doing all sorts of public intake and informational meetings, that we'll be coordinating this not only internally but with the EDA staff and their communications people to make sure that the message is clear, the message is consistent, but the means that we gather the feedback from the community is, again, consistent and people understand when it is, through a schedule like this, when it is that decisions are going to be made, input processes are going to be offered, and with that, I'm just going to stop because I can just keep talking for a long time. So we'll happy to entertain any questions, and again, we'll go over this in a lot greater detail on Thursday afternoon.
Just let me make one prior comment. What this will lead to is in about a month or so, I don't know when you have these contracts worked out, they'll be coming to you with for approval of multi-year engineering contracts in some cases to get this work done, because that's what the belief is, that this is the level of effort that is needed. And so we'll be heading, that'll be the next thing that you will see on your end of the table on this.
And I understand you're working on that and the budget and so forth, but where do you anticipate this is funded from?
Well, it's funded from the, the county's $3 million is the main funding source for this.
Their
transit tax. And so we've asked for, I've had discussions with Dick Devlin and with Bob Benzig and actually with Jim Beer, and I don't think the county has any problem making the commitment. Their funding has a maximum annually under the law, unless their share when the full transit funding is flowing would be about $3 million. And what we've asked for is a letter from them that the $3 million would be available next year, the year after, for starters, so that we can get through these contracts and then get on to the whole federal process. At the end of the day, if you start bonding for transit, you're going to need the $3 million a year to help bond for construction projects down the road. But they've been very accommodating. They've been great partners on this, and I think you'll have that letter forthcoming soon.
So on July 6th, we would intend to have an RCA, based on the direction we get on Thursday, for you to approve an amendment to SRF's contract with the city for them to hire the staff and the firms that are part of this process. And so we'll just be doing one contract. It'll be a contract amendment to their contract with us. They will then be contracting, and they will then have the ability to direct and control the work of those consultants. We think this is a very efficient process to use, instead of us contracting and then having a contract with them, and we get kind of everybody's pointing at everybody else, so who's responsible. We get the question at the board meeting, who's in charge? Okay, we're going to make Ken in charge of the study. Well, you're in charge of the study, so, and I'm in charge of you.
And I will say that the contracts will have to be kind of like the state does their contracts at times, in which every year there's an end of the year deadline that if the funding isn't provided, then the contract has to be amended or terminated if that's the case. So, like for the $3 million number that you get from the county, you'll have that information in July.
And that'll be good to hear. I think part of my sensitivity, and then I'm not quibbling with what you're talking about here, I think we do have to do due diligence. This is a fairly significant part of the whole puzzle. But I also am cognizant of the fact that we've been fronting a lot of the money for a lot of studies. And, I understand we're at a 2 or an 8, and so we've got to be candid with people in that, because some people are going to hear more studies, more money, and when we start delivering. So we're going to have to make sure that we're very candid in telling people, what we're trying to accomplish and why, and then also where the funding is coming from.
And I would mention one thing you might want to consider is that even under the conservative plan, it shows the potential. We're not saying that's a real number,
right?
For $900 million in costs in these areas. So obviously, for those kind of construction costs, that's parking included in there along with transit. It's the largest bucket of construction cost by far that you're going to run into on the DOC, so it's going to take some...
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Mr. Ruska.
I'm trying to get clear on this. Is Tom Brennan and Sharon Green, are they going to be employees of yours then, or of just extra consultants? Or
yes.
Are they getting paid too then to be part of this?
Yes, they're in an advisory role because they... Sharon is an expert in the environmental area of federal funding. So as we start to try to leverage federal funds for the circulator in particular and possibly even the city loop, we need somebody that has some expertise in that area. And so, yes, they would be.
Okay. Other questions, comments? Again, I know we get a lot of this on Thursday again, but any immediate question, Mr. Cantor?
It's challenging. I think we all took some of the utterances to heart a little bit about, you know, trying to move and move forward. So, you know, I'm appreciative to see staff come back with, you know, a meaningful assessment here of what needs to be done. I think that there is some work here, and it's not just transit. So that's, maybe a scapegoat a little bit right now. But there's, you know, other aspects of this plan, too, that... Maybe if we're aware that it looks like the earliest we're going to come back is, I'm not really good with Gantt charts, August of 2017, what else can we do in the interim? And I think that's, maybe a question for us to answer at a leadership level in between then and now. What does this look like? What's the initiative continue to look like during that time? Because I think, it's just going to be unfortunate if people keep harping on something that we know has a timeline now. I think it's about kind of filling the hopper with some other things that people can point at.
Well, that's what the intent of the interim parking plan. That's a big deal. And also, I don't think there's anything in here that should stop projects from moving forward. I mean, an assessment can be made of, the location and its TRR, its traffic impact report impact, and we're not seeing things that would delay projects. It would be a rare project, at least, if that were to occur. So there's nothing to stop things from moving forward, but that interim parking plan, I think, would be quite useful.
And one thing that the entire group agreed upon, all of the people that are involved in these studies, is that if we can test alternatives, if we can actually do some field test of things before we actually commit to a final decision on them. So, for example, on the circulator, we can run city buses on that route, for example, for 3 months and see the level of congestion that it may create, if nothing else, or the level of ridership, or test a lot of different things. What is the runtime? You can model it all you want in a computer, but let's put those buses out there in traffic at 5 o'clock and see, can we maintain a 5-minute headway between St. Mary's and the Mayo Building? So test a lot of the theories, a lot of the things that are coming forth. I mean, The level of parking, the DMC plan still proposes 16,000 additional parking stalls downtown in garages, 16,000 more. That still is a hard number to get my hands around and think that's realistic when we have 3,000 now. And that's, if we do all these other things, we only need 16. Because if we don't do all of these other aspects with TMA and other things like that, we could need as many as 30,000. That's scary. That reminds me of when we went to Des Moines, and every block you looked, east and west and north and south, there was a parking garage.
It's true.
That's right. Yep. And we don't want that kind of downtown. So we've got to do a lot of validation on a lot of the information that was there and just a lot of proofing of it. And that's a lot of what we're going to be doing in the next 8 to 10 months.
I'm excited to see some of those prototypes because I think that's the sort of stuff that people can start to visualize what we're actually talking about. When we take a bus, let's put a circulator banner on the side and drive it around for a few hours and see how excited people get about it. I think it's something. It's something we can do to start whetting the appetite.
Well, as Michael said, we've had Civic Center Drive closed in front of the Civic Center now for a year, and okay. So I mean,
but wait.
No, I'm just saying. But that would be the kind of test that we would do. So what happens if you make Second Street one lane in each direction? Well, I think we all have an opinion, but until we do it, do we know? And so that's the kind of field test we're talking about. If you closed 3rd Street between Broadway and 1st Avenue West, for example, what impact would that actually have? So again, there's been different suggestions that people have had already, or comments we're getting from the public. Well, what if you do this and what if you do that? So, I'm not saying that, Ed, that we're going to do it, but it's just an example how.
Well, but it's making it sound like it's acceptable to cut it down one lane, and no. If you've been down there at all, it's not acceptable at all. And people are staying away from it.
But we wouldn't have known that had we not tested it.
Okay,
and that's what we're saying. Test the theory, test the concept as best we can with some actual field. You know, we'll buy a bunch of orange cones.
And we saw that in an article that was forwarded to us, I think, over the last weekend I saw it at the conference where they used temporary barriers, and they essentially created a bike lane with just fencing. And it didn't work. Take the fencing down. Yeah.
You can't just go out and do it, though, without, public education.
Agreed.
I mean, once you've decided to do it, you've done your marketing, whatever, then you can do some temporary things.
Yes, but it was cheaper than striping and then scrubbing the striping off. But anyway, there are ways to test it.
Okay. Sorry for running over.
Anything else? If not, we will be adjourned and see everyone in the morning.